Okay. Yeah. Page 146. And parshas by Yetzer. 8 o'clock. 8 o'clock tomorrow. Yeah. It's interesting. You know, they talk about, and we're going to see a few examples of this, a person's spiritual well-being, a person's emotional state, has a tremendous impact on their ability to function. And this is something that experience tells us. That was a different difference here. This is something that experience tells us. When you're depressed, when you're down, it's almost, you know, it can become impossible to function at all.
Your endorphins.
To get out of bed. You can give it a chemical description. But when you have that experience, just even doing the most mundane things become very difficult, become painful to do. And then on the other hand, though, when you have energy, when you're excited, when you're energized, you have the ability to do things that otherwise you wouldn't have thought you had the capability to do. And it really all depends on a person's spirituality, a person's state of well-being and a state of mind. And Kadosh Baruch Hu built us that way, that the guf and the neshama are really tied one into the other. That your neshama, your personality, your well-being is tied into your body and tied into, as you say, your endorphins or whatever the chemical reaction is, right? That does exist, that's true. But what triggers it? How do you influence it? Meaning that you can mask the phenomenon for a limited period of time through chemical means. But they say you can't treat depression with pills. Right, you have to treat it also with therapy too. And it's a combination of both of them. So it's just a very interesting thing, you know, how, and when we talk about ruchnius, spirituality, people usually, they attach spirituality to some sort of feeling that they can't really describe to you. You know, oh, I felt so spiritual. Let me ask, okay, what does that mean? I felt close to God, I felt energy, I felt... Whereas what ruchnius really is, spirituality really is, I think, is a person has a sense of meaning, a sense of purpose, and a sense that they're accomplishing and that they're moving forward. Because without which, and that really gives you a lot of energy to accomplish. So sometimes you'll feel like that, you know, when you're in a spiritual time, you're on Yom Kippur, and you reach out to God and you feel very spiritual. But a person can feel very spiritual, you know, by doing the mundane things also, by, you know, by... Erev Pesach also. I mean, by, you know... You know, I like to give the example, you can find spirituality when you're diapering your child as well. And your kid, or your grandchildren, your great-grandchildren, right? You can find spirituality in that too, if that's towards your goals, that's meaning towards your aim. And very often people, they're searching for this spirituality nowadays. We talk about the spirituality everybody's looking for. So they try yoga, and they try, you know, ashrams. What?
Tai Chi.
Well, you don't do that for spirituality, I hope. But, do you?
Sure, I feel good.
See, but that's what they equate. That's not spirituality I'm talking about. They're looking for this epiphany, and they think that, oh, you know, if I just do the right thing, it'll come to me. I want to come to shul and feel spiritual. And those people, when they come to this shul at least, right, they're always looking for the wrong thing, and they never find it here. Because when somebody comes to a real shul, and they come to davening, the davening, yes, is about communicating with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but it isn't a one-shot deal. It's about maintaining a relationship. It's about keeping that going, having that sense of purpose, having that sense of dedication to God. As opposed to, you know, and they're going to go to some temple or some, you know, cure thing, and they're going to be running and dancing and, you know, shaking and having a great time. That's very nice, and they feel this great energy, and they think that's spirituality, but when they leave, what do they have left? They don't have anything to take with them. Well, nice memories. It's almost like Chinese food. Everybody, you know, people like to eat Chinese food. The problem with Chinese food is you're hungry 10 minutes after you leave. Right? That's what they say. What's Chinese food? Too sweet. Okay. So anyway, this principle comes up a number of times in the section we're going to read in the parsha. Okay, it's 146 and by Yetzer. Okay? It's interesting. We're going to have to discuss Yaakov's predicament, because there are some things about Yaakov's predicament that really are troubling. And Rashi raises them, and we have to really analyze what Rashi has to tell us. So the Torah says, you know, we all know Yaakov runs away from Beersheba. Yaakov runs away from Beersheba, and he goes to Haran. Why is he running away? Yeah, why else?
mother.
Why? And his mother didn't just send him for that. Well, why did she send him?
To find a wife.
Right, to find a wife.
A wife.
A wife. Well, to find wives, I don't know. Now, it's interesting. I just thought of this now. Why is it that Rivka doesn't send him to find a wife beforehand? Was he always waiting for the bracha, for Yitzchak to give the bracha before he sent him off to get married? I don't really know. How come Yaakov never got married?
Was Esau
married? Esau had been married to a number of wives.
And
sure, the Benos Kenan. He found the Benos Kenan.
Right?
Why did Yaakov never get married?
He was learning.
He was learning. He was learning Torah. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Which tells you that you should learn and then get married and not the other way around.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Okay. Because what happens as soon as he gets married?
Your mind is not.
He has to get a job. Somebody's got to support the family,
right?
And his father-in-law certainly wasn't going to do it. Imagine telling Lavan, "Hey, Dad, I want to go learn in Kollel. Yeah, you'll go work. Right, you know, no thanks."
Didn't marry a PhD, Papa.
No, Papa had dough. Papa wasn't given no dough. Papa had plenty of dough. Okay, so we're on Pasuk Aleph in Perek Chaf Tes. Vayisa Yaakov Radlav. Yaakov lifted up his feet, Vayelech Archa B'nei Kedem. And he went Archa B'nei Kedem to the land of B'nei Kedem. Kedem means, what is Kedem in the left? Right, to the east. Which way was he really going in this case? Northeast. He's following his favorite up towards, I think, Syria, towards Damascus, towards towards the eastern northern place. What in this passage doesn't fit? Is that necessary? Yeah. Right, it says, Vayisha Yaakov Raglav. If I just ignore that, what if I said, Vayelech Ard Yaakov Archa B'nei Kedem? Yaakov, after the whole thing, remember, the part I'm skipping, we're not doing today, is the dream, and the angels going up and down, and the promise with God. I think we did that a couple of years ago. All right, we'll come to it again next year. Okay? So I'm skipping all that. So then the Torah says, when he wakes up the next morning, he has, they make the promise to God, and then he decides it's time to go. Vayisha Yaakov Raglav, Vayelech Archa B'nei Kedem. What do I need to say? Vayisha Yaakov Raglav.
Well, that's in a hurry.
He picked up his feet.
Yeah, that's in a hurry.
Vayisha Raglav means he picked up his feet in a hurry.
Mm-hmm. That's what I
think. Okay, interesting. What's that?
He doesn't shuffle.
He's still young. Let's look at Rashi. What does Rashi say? Aleph Rashi, which is two lines from the bottom in the Rashis in the second column. See the second column, two lines from the bottom? Yeah. Mishrit Basher B'sorah Tova, when he received the good news, Shehuftach B'shmira, God promised him that when he would go, he would be guarded. Nasal libo et raglav v'na'aseh kal lalechet. His heart carried his feet, and he became easy to go. Right. This is what I started with. And what I wanted to ask you is, why does Rashi say this here? I mean, Rashi's quoting the Midrash. Where would the Midrash base this idea upon? If I just said, by Yisai Yaakov Raglav, he picked up his feet, would you get from this that he was light on his feet, and he started to go very quickly, he was very excited to go? Is that what you would take from there?
No.
I'm asking you, the phrase by Yisai Raglav, by Yisai Yaakov, and he picked up his feet, would you get from that he was happy?
Yeah.
At this point, after
bracha,
before that he was...
After God's bracha, you say, yes?
Yes. Before that he was sort of...
Okay, I agree with you. I'm not going to disagree with you. I think that it's logical here. But it also, we're going to fit it into a context. And what I want to show you is that this Rashi and this Midrash fits into a certain context. Now, I saw somewhere else. Let me see if I can find it. Okay, I'm not going to quote Sforno. Look at Orachaim. Orachaim says, "Vayishai Yaakov Raglav," what it means, "Nidkaven bazeh ki ani haya." He was poor. "Velohayo lo lisa rak raglav." Meaning, what else should he have picked up? What should Yaakov have picked up?
His whole luggage.
His luggage, his clothes, his whatever. When Yaakov went to sleep, what did he sleep on?
A rock.
A stone. Why did he sleep on a stone? He never can. That's why he slept on a stone. There was nothing else to sleep on. So there's an obvious question. What's the obvious question?
What luggage did he have?
What?
He didn't have anything.
He had nothing. So what's the obvious question? Right. Why? How do you go on a trip with nothing? Man, this isn't a trip. I mean, to be honest with you, you have to like...
A whole change.
You have to think to yourself, if I was flying from here to New York, okay, and I knew that when I was going to go there, I was going to meet somebody, first of all, I would take luggage. But even if I didn't want to take luggage, they have food at the airport, they have whatever I'm wearing, it's all climate controlled, I'm going to park at the airport. I mean, you know, let's be honest, he's traveling from Be'er Sheva
to Haran.
How?
By foot.
By foot. Wonderful. So you're saying that he was like Bnei Yisrael and Midbar and the clothes were with him. You think so?
That Hashem would be with him.
Yeah, that's right.
And the
clothes
are just growing.
Yeah.
Okay. You read that about Bnei Yisrael or about Yaakov? I know. Well, there's a lot of miraculous things that the Midrash says happened in the desert. All I'm saying to you is it's very unusual. Where's all this stuff?
Didn't he leave his possessions and Esau's son came after?
How do you know that?
Because I read the Midrash.
Right. So why would the Midrash say that? It's a pretty wacky story, isn't it?
Yes,
it is. Yeah, where's that from? Let's look at Rashi. Well, let's read on a little bit and we'll see Rashi. Actually, we'll skip there for now because it's the same question. Skip to Pasuk Yud Aleph. Yud Aleph. We're gonna skip and then come back. Vayishak Yaakov l'Rachel. Yaakov kissed Rachel. Vayishat kolo vayefk. And he raises up his voice
and he cried.
And he cried.
From happiness.
He was happy. He didn't have anything to give him.
Where do you get that from?
Don't read English. I just remember.
Good. How do you know? Look at Rashi. Very good. Yud Aleph. Vayefk. Vayefk. Last line in the first column of Rashi in the bottom. Lefi shetzipa beruach hakodesh she'eina nichneset imo lekzura. Why did he cry? Because he saw beruach hakodesh that he would not be buried together with him. So he was sad about that. Yay, very interesting. What?
People cry when they're happy.
Oh, okay. Could be when he's happy. What?
Some people cry when they're happy. You know.
When's the last time Yaakov cried? To our record.
I don't know.
When did he cry?
Next time, brother, I think.
In our record, he's never cried before. So you're saying he's happy? That's why he cries? Okay. Davar acher, top line in Rashi in the second column. Davar acher, lefi sheba b'yadayim rekaniyot. Why was he upset? Why was he crying? Because
yes.
He comes empty-handed. Amar, he said, Eliezer eved avi abba hayu b'yadav nizamim uchmidim umigdanot. When my grandfather's slave came here so many years ago to pick up my mother, he came with jewelry and bracelets and gifts. Vani ein b'yadi klum. I don't have anything. Now, Rashi wants to know, why? How could it be he has nothing with him? When Yaakov left the house, how did he leave?
In a hurry.
Okay. How did he leave? Who sent him?
His mother
sent him. Don't get me wrong. If your mother, if you were sending away your son on a long distance trip, wouldn't you pack him a lunch? Would you give him some money? Do you have any money? Would you give him a credit card? On a long, dangerous journey?
Think so.
Traveling, I mean, this time he's traveling literally around the known world, across the known world. It's going almost as far as you can go. Where's the sheikah? Why doesn't he have anything?
He'll have to survive.
Good, it's a survival course? For Yaakov, the simple Yaakovala, the each time the Yosebo Halim, the kid who was afraid to confront his father, his mother had to say, I'll take care of you. And then you're going to send him out in the wilderness? Yeah. So look at what Rashi says. The Fisha Radaf Eliphaz ben Esav b'mitzvat Aviv acharav lahargo. So Rashi has to explain, why didn't he have any money? Esav sent his son Eliphaz to run after Yaakov to kill him. Did he she go? Eliphaz caught up to him, caught him. Ulufisha gadal Eliphaz b'chekol shel Yitzchak. Eliphaz grew up in the house of Yitzchak, his grandfather. Mashach Yadav. So he couldn't kill Yaakov. He couldn't kill his uncle. So he has a conundrum. On the one hand, I can't kill my uncle because he's my grandfather's son. But on the other hand, my father, kibbutz of the aim. What am I supposed to do? No, what can you do? Amalo Yaakov says, Yaakov, toma sibiyadi, take all I had. And Ani is like a dead person in the eyes of the Midrash. Ani chashiv kimeis. That must be what happened. Okay.
Well, I mean, Rivka obviously gave something, and
then
that was the end of it.
He
took everything that he had.
It makes sense to you? That story makes sense to you? Oh, that's what happened.
I mean, what? It's a medrash, but this is not a medrash.
It's a medrash, right. What's the point of a medrash? What do you do with a medrash like that?
Question it.
Okay, I question it too. So, first thing you have to ask yourself is, do I believe that it's factual? If I don't believe that it's factual, meaning, if I don't believe that it actually happened, then what's the purpose of the Midrash?
Well, it explains why he had nothing to give
it her. It fills in the holes in the text.
Yeah.
But if it fills, what's the point of filling the hole in the text with something that seems very far-fetched?
Well, it could be.
A lot of things could be. Maybe aliens flew down from the sky and stole all his money and then went back to planet Zoo.
Nephew,
but
Rabbi
spoke,
there is deep truth to
this. Oh, what's the deep truth?
Deep
okay.
Truth, a person who has nothing doesn't count more.
Correct. I agree with you, but you know that's true. But I want to ask you a question, Mrs. Seligson. Do you think that's what happened?
I think it's very possible that could have happened.
That Esav sent Eliphaz, his son. Esav sent. One second. First of all, there's a first factual problem is the following. Esav said, I'm going to kill my brother. When am I going to kill my brother?
When
he vowed to kill his brother. When?
His father dies.
When his father dies. So now you're telling me the Midrash is saying something that goes against the text. Because he swore not to kill his brother until after his father was dead. So how would he then send his son to go kill him?
Well, he figured he was going to kill him.
It wasn't he wasn't going to kill him because it would kill his father. So out of respect for his father, he didn't want Yaakov to be killed.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
He did not want to kill Yaakov.
Well, the son is younger.
Yeah.
He did not want to kill him.
It would have been a double
whammy, that one son kills the other as opposed to the grandson killing the son? I think you're right. I think that if Lo Aleinu, a person has a grandson and he kills his son, that's better.
For Esau, for sure.
No.
Except that maybe the son was not a fantasy.
And obviously, it's interesting. It says that the Midrash says that Eliphaz couldn't do it. Why? Because he grew up in Yitzchak's house. So did Esav, by the way. Esav also grew up in Yitzchak's house.
Oh, a different kind of guy.
Not in the house. In the lap
of him. That's interesting. It's very, 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 it's a beautiful text. He grew up in the lap of Esav, so he couldn't bring himself to do it.
Okay.
Yeah. Excuse me, can I help you?
Yeah, I got a delivery.
For? Okay, do you know where to put it? Go ahead. Okay, thank you. You go from the outside. From the inside, you can open it. Okay. I guess it's on the take now. Yeah.
That's very interesting.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Yeah. I don't know. See, it's interesting. The Midrash has to fill something in. It has to fill in details because the question is so overpowering. If I were to objectively, you think that he would have left with money. So either you have to say he left with money and somehow he lost it, or he didn't leave with money. So if you say the first one, you have to explain how did he lose it.
Rocky.
What?
Could have been.
Right. So I think that the Midrash is twofold. On the one hand, the Midrash wants to say that yes, he did leave with money. He left prepared. But on the other hand, one always gets the sense that when dealing with Esav, Esav, in the eyes of the Midrash, is always representative of something. What is it representative of?
Bad guy.
What?
He's the bad guy.
Why?
Conniver.
Why? Why Esav? Well, you're absolutely correct. What does Esav represent in the eyes of the Midrash very often? Why the bad guy? Why is Esav always painted in such a bad light? Esav, by the way, if you would look at the act of Esav objectively, okay, Esav makes mistakes, but he's not really an evil person. I mean, let's be honest. How would you feel if your younger brother stole your birthright from your father and tricked you? Okay, let me put it this way. How would you feel if you're the older son and your mother connived together with your brother in order to trick your father and give him something that you were supposed to get?
Mm-hmm.
How would you feel?
He's a sibling. My mother
likes. He's angry. And then what does Esav do in the end to Yaakov? What does he do in the end? In the very end. So he had a temporary moment of anger. What does he do in the end?
He forgets,
and he goes lives in his own. Well, you know, Esav's such a bad guy.
Not really.
Objectively not.
He had a choice to prevent this. But he sold it. He said, "I'm going to die anyway." So what?
I understand. Esav, I wouldn't say is the sharpest tack in the bunch. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I don't think he's the sharpest knife in the silverware. I agree with you. But does that make him evil?
No.
Right. So why does the Midrash there say that when Esav went out, he was Ovid of Azara, he was Gilead Arias and Shvichas Dam, he was a murderer, he was a rapist, he was he was an adulterer. Why does he say that?
He was not entitled.
Why does the Midrash say that? Where in the text do you ever find such a thing that Esav did on any of those things? So what I'm going to tell you is, Esav in the Midrash is representative of a certain thing. When did the rabbis live? When did Chazal live? They lived in times of the Gemara, in times of the Mishnah, in times of the Gemara, correct? That's when the Midrashim were created. Okay? Who is Esav represent? Esav represents Malchut Edom. Right? Esav is a representative of his descendants. Every nation has their descendants. The descendants of Esav is Malchut Edom. How did the Jews feel about Malchut Edom?
It was an enemy.
Why? Malchut Edom, it means all of. Basically, the entire known world after the Canaanite, after the Bayit Rishon, any enemy that we had afterwards, the Greeks, the Romans, all of them, they were all from the descendants of Esav. So Esav becomes, he personifies every enemy the Jews have later on in life. You have to really read history in that way and understand that when people talk about Esav, Esav was a code word for
evil.
My Roman neighbor, the Roman lord, the Greek minister. That's who Esav was.
She shows that everywhere the Jews went, there was somebody out to kill them.
Correct. So what does the Gemara say about Esav? The Gemara says, halacha psuka. It's halacha, the Gemara says, Esav sone es Yaakov.
They hated
him. Not hated. Esav sone et Yaakov. Esav hates Yaakov, which, as we all know, doesn't portend well for American Jewry. Sometimes we get along, sometimes we don't get along, but you should always know, deep down, there's that seething hatred. And I don't care how many ADLs you sponsor, and how many APACs you create, it might be powerful for a time, but eventually, that hatred will bubble to the top. Halacha psuka. If you believe in the words of Chazal, it's not pressing. It's not depressing. It should be pressing. If you believe that it's true, do you believe that it's true? Then you should be pushing your children and your grandchildren not to be here. Because I don't think it, you know, one would hope to choose that it's not going to happen. Maybe in my lifetime, I don't know. Personally, I believe that it will happen in my lifetime. No, but it's a better place to be a Jew. No, not even Ruchani. I had somebody put it to me this way. He said, after those terrible bombings in Turkey, he said, Rabbi, do we honestly think, lo aleinu, it shouldn't happen. It shouldn't happen. But do you honestly think that we're immune here in America?
No.
Don't think it for a moment. Don't think it for a minute. The only thing we have going for us is numbers, to be honest with you. Because the odds are you can't hit every Jew. But I hate to say it, but it's easier in America. Much easier. And it's a frightening thought, it's a pachad. So somebody said to me, he said, listen, if I'm going to die because I'm a Jew, I hope it's not in Oak Park. I'd rather do it over there. Allah ha-psuka, Esav sone es Yaakov. So therefore, you find a midrash like this. And what happens? How do I fill in the details? Why is Yaakov poor? Why are Jews poor? Why in the times of the Romans are Jews poor and oppressed in the times of the Greeks? Because the Romans came or the Greeks came and they stole our money.
Right.
So why is Yaakov Avinu destitute? What must have happened? Because Esav sent his children and he sent his son and he wanted to kill him, and the only way we could get away from being killed, being murdered, being pillaged, is to buy them off.
And we do that, we get that too.
That happens in my personal experience. This is not my experience today in America. Not yet. Shouldn't happen, but not yet. So therefore, why? What premeditates a midrash like that? So I don't know if it's true, if it happened, if it actually happened to Yaakov then. But what I can tell you is it happened to Yaakov later on, many, many, many times over. And that's the feeling. That's what I feel when I see a midrash articulate something like that. That's how I understand a midrash like that. Because it fills in the, like you say, it fills in the details, it gives you the picture, and it's not really important whether that actually happened to Yaakov. So I personally believe, I'm not sure I believe that that's what happened to Yaakov. Because I think if that happened to Yaakov, Mrs. Rohrberg, what would I find? Wouldn't the Chumash say something? If Esau sent his son to go kill Yaakov and he stole all his money, how could the Chumash ignore a salient detail like that? I mean, it's a pretty important thing, don't you think?
Yes.
So I see that as more filling in the picture of giving us a historical understanding and a theological understanding of the relationship between Esau and Yaakov, as opposed to what really happened. But if that's true, then I'm stuck with a question. What question am I stuck with? If I don't believe that the Midrash is actually factually correct about the events that happened to Yaakov Avinu,
so where was his money?
What happened to Yaakov's money?
Yeah, right.
He didn't.
What happened to Yaakov? So first of all, how long does it take Yaakov to get from Beersheba to Haran?
One day.
How long does it take to get to Yerushalayim? Is it really quick?
It's
not, but
it's
one day.
No,
he might have had
two times. He's a Fadarek, right? He picks up the seed and the sun is setting and then he goes straight. Okay, so he didn't stop on the way. So then I'm stuck with the idea that Yaakov left with nothing. Why would he do such a thing?
Well, what was he supposed to do? He wasn't going to go back home.
He didn't run away. His mother sent him away.
I know, but he was not going back home to get more money.
His mother sent him away. Why didn't his mother send him with something?
Brothers, so maybe he figured he'd get what he needed over there.
Well, until he got there, he'd need something.
Right. What did he eat on the way?
Oh, there are things to eat.
Berries and fruits? Whatever you could find.
Yeah.
Very strange, don't you think?
Yeah.
He wanted to lose weight. He wanted to lose weight. He went on the all-berry diet.
Oh, he walked.
He walked. I'm saying to you is the whole thing strikes me as unusual, and I don't personally have a great answer to the question.
Maybe this was
what? That you should go with nothing and survive? What did he have for breakfast the day he woke up?
I don't know.
He didn't tell.
Scrambled eggs.
Didn't have scrambled eggs. He's missing some good stuff. Okay.
But you know, Rabbi Spolter, it is interesting to see and to watch how you want to project yourself in 2003.
Yeah.
Into a situation when this midrash was written. It's thousands of years ago.
Yes. I'm not extrapolating our time. First of all, that's what Midrash is for. The Midrash is all about saying it didn't just happen then, it happens always.
Yeah.
The second thing I'm saying is I think that the Chazal at the time were trying to say exactly that. Yaakov's life teaches us about what we're going through now. Why are we suffering now? I mean, I actually can't say it about 2003. I don't suffer at the hands of Edom. Do I? I mean, does anybody here feel persecuted by the Edomites? By the nations of the world. If anybody persecutes us today, it's Yishmael. We have our problems with Yishmael. Edom, not right now. 50 years ago, we had Edom problems. Today, we don't. It's interesting how things turn, isn't it? Very interesting. So anyway, all I'm saying to you is that I think that that's how Chazal learned the Chumash. What they were saying is what happened to Yaakov. And they said what happened to Yaakov is what's happening to us today, 2,000 years ago. Because believe me, they had plenty of problems with Edom. Edom was their biggest problem. Was their worst problem. Okay.
Because it was our own. That's what
Yishmael is our
because it's yeah.
You always fight with the ones you love the most. Yeah. You fight it, you know.
I wouldn't argue with Yishmael. I wouldn't argue with an Arab. I believe.
Why?
I can't stand it.
Any Arab?
My stuff. Oh yeah, well I know. My father could stand up to that.
Ah, you could.
I hope you never
What?
No, I want to hear your answer to
this. I don't know. I give you my answer. Well, I have a sort of answer. I don't know.
I'll tell you one thing. When my husband was in the hospital, and an Arab came to take a doctor came to look at my husband, I felt funny about it, but I didn't say anything. But my trippy, the one that's in California, says to him, how do you feel treating my dad? He says, oh, I'm a doctor. She says, you know, I don't want you to be my father's doctor.
Really?
And he walked out. He said, I don't feel good.
How
you
like the
opposite? I know, but my trippy said she definitely didn't want him to be treated by
me. Why?
Why?
She said.
First of all, how do you know? Was he a Christian Arab or a Muslim Arab?
We didn't ask him.
Okay.
I don't remember this.
What, you hate all Arabs?
Yes.
I don't. Absolutely not. I don't think you can do that. How do you do that?
I don't look at them the same way.
I stay away.
I think that that's a very dangerous way to feel.
I know.
You know why? Because it goes both ways.
Of course. I know.
So, you can't complain when somebody does it to us if you're willing to do it to other people.
Well, I can't change myself. I've had it.
There are many wonderful Arabs. Many wonderful Arabs. Yeah, there are plenty of great, there are plenty of wonderful Arabs.
I know there are.
So, I mean, you know, I don't think it would bother me to have an Arab doctor at all. At all.
Wow. I'll try and stay away.
I don't know. I don't understand it. I really don't. What's that?
It was an error. It was the sweetest man you could want to see.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
It was the best doctor you could want to meet.
Yes.
He made a sugar call to my house.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
See?
Mm-hmm. That's the practicing that's not an Arab doctor.
Just because a person is born a certain way doesn't mean they have, you know, they have hatred in their heart. And that they,
why can't we get along? Why can't the rest of them get along? Like, well, my doctor, he's best of friends with my doctor.
You know, even if you have things that you disagree on, I feel strongly about that. That's a very dangerous thing.
Yeah.
Well, not necessarily. Not everybody who's Arab.
A doctor I would trust. If they reach that much area that they're healing people.
Right, I don't
well,
know.
Well, I hope
on the street on the dark end in your car again on Monday.
I know. I'm by the way,
at Apple Store, you can't like Arabs.
I know.
That
I do. I get gas. But I'm kind of scared. I really am. I've been with them. I've lived with them, so I know.
Okay, I'm not going to go there. Okay. Pasuk Bet. Vayar, and he saw. So he walks on, he gets there. He gets there quickly. Vayar, and he saw. Vihinei be'er basadeh. There is a well in the field. Vihinei sham shlosha edrei tzon ropchim aleha. There are three flocks of sheep that are ropchim aleha, that are surrounding it, lay beside it. Ki min ha-be'er ha-hi yeshu ha-adarim. Because from this be'er, from this well, the adarim, the flocks would drink. Ve'ha'even gidola al pi ha-be'er. And the stone is on the mouth of this well. Now, this is very interesting. This whole description seems a little bit unusual. What's unusual about it, or abnormal?
A lot of description about a well.
Yeah, right, it's a well. You know, like, I mean, come on, you know.
Chayim.
Ah, very beautiful. So listen, both the Ramban and the Rabbeinu Bachya, they say that there are other interpretations of this pasuk. There are much deeper interpretations. The Ramban has such a powerful, beautiful, beautiful interpretation. Says Ramban. He says, Rabotena b'bereshit rabba, our rabbis in Bereshit rabba, gam bazeh lehem sod remez la'atid. In this pasuk they found a sod, a hint, a sod, a secret, a remez, a hint for the future. Ki mizamen lo kacha shenichnas b'derech ha-be'er. Why did it happen that it came through the way of the well, the path of the well? Why were there only three flocks? So you have, why not all of the flocks? Okay, so why did he come when the stone was on there and they're all waiting for it? He says, what is the well? The well represents the Beit HaMikdash. The Gimel Edrei Tzon, what are the three flocks, says the Ramban? Those are the Olei Shlosha Regalim. Those are the three Regalim, the three holidays throughout the year. Ki min ha-be'er ha-hi yashku ha-adarim. When the Bnei Israel come up on those three holidays, they drink from the well, from the spiritual well of the Beit HaMikdash. Shemisham hayu shoavim ruach ha-kodesh. From there, from the Beit HaMikdash, they all had ruach ha-kodesh. They all had God's spirit. Right? Or because the Torah comes from Tzion, from the Nei Israel. And then Based on that, all of the Adarim, all of the flax will gather. They galalu ek ha'eben v'yishru, and then they'll roll off that stone and drink. Shemisham hayu shoravim ruach ha'kodesh. They would take the rock off of the well, they would take the stopper off the well, and the ruach ha'kodesh would come flowing out of the Beis HaMikdash. And would inspire everyone who was there. And then they shivu et ha'eben, they would put the rock back. Munach l'regel haba. They would be filling, they would have enough water, enough spiritual water, that would keep them sustained until the next holiday that would come the next time. Oh, beautiful. Actually, it's so beautiful, such a moving idea. What? It's a beautiful allegory, so powerful, you know, that Yaakov came on this way, and it was a hint to him that these three flocks would be the Shalosh Regalim. It's interesting. So that's one, and listen to the midrash that's brought by Rabbi Bache. He brings a different midrash. Rabbi Yochanan Patar Bakrai B'Sinai. So Rabbi Yochanan said, no, it wasn't talking about the Shalosh Regalim. Rather, the Be'er, the well, is representing of Har Sinai. Be'er Sadeh is Zeh Sinai. V'nei Shlam Shlosha Egreitzon. What are the three flocks? Anybody want to guess?
The three holidays.
Very good. Kohani, Elu Kohanim Levim Yisraelim. The three flocks are the three types of Jews. Kinami Be'er Hayi Yashku. So what did the Jewish people drink from the well of Har Sinai? Right. Elu Aseret HaDibra, the Ten Commandments.
Okay.
What was the great rock? Zeus Shechina. That's God's presence. And they gathered, that's the Bnei Yisrael. And they, when they rolled off the stone, that means that they accepted the Torah upon themselves. So again, everyone sees this allegory as being this detail of the Be'er, of the well. It's not superfluous, but rather it's there to give you a flavor, to give you some more information, to give you some backgrounds, to feed, you know, to give you some nourishment, as it were, some spiritual nourishment. And you see that the Be'er, we always say that the Torah is considered like Mayim Chayim, like the well of water. So when you have a pasuk like this in the Torah, where there's a well and the flax and they're waiting for the rock to come off and they're all going to drink from the well, it's there as an allegory to reveal to us some beautiful ideas about Bnei Yisrael and the future of the Jewish people. It's just, I wanted to share that with you because it's a nice stuff, very beautiful
is that
stuff.
A chumash.
Besides Rabbeinu Bachaya quotes a midrash and the Ramban quotes a different midrash. Very often, so Rabbeinu Bachaya and the Ramban don't always quote the midrashim. So you know, if they find a midrash that they like to quote, they're very, you know, that it's something they're excited about. Okay. Let's go on. Pasuk Gimel. V'ne'eshu shama kol ha'adarim. All the flocks would gather there. V'galalu et ha'evin me'al pi ha'be'er. Then they would remove the stone from on the well. V'ishku et ha'chod. And they would water the sheep. They shivu et ha'evin al pi ha'be'er l'mkoma. And then they would return the stone to the well, of the well, to its place. What was obviously the purpose of this stone?
To keep the water clean.
Keep the water clean.
Yeah. No.
It shouldn't be wasted.
By? No.
To keep it cool.
No. What's the purpose of the stone?
To hold the water in the ground.
In case?
Somebody spills.
Right. But they intentionally put a stone there that's too big for one person by himself to lift. Mm-hmm. Because obviously, what are they afraid of? Someone's going to come and water his flocks, and the water was limited in quantity, mm-hmm. and it wasn't always, the well wasn't always full. Somebody would come and water their flocks, and they would clearly water their flocks, and now everybody's sheep would drink. So I have wonderful sheep with great shearings and great offspring, and their sheep would be, you know, starving to death. So therefore, they made it in such a way that only a number of people together would be able to take off the water. Mm-hmm. Now, let me ask you, why did they do this?
Right.
It's very interesting. Yaakov is coming in to a certain place. He's coming to a place where I think that this is really the beginning and introduction to Yaakov's life. Even from last week. Yaakov is a neophyte. It's a neophyte? It's a babe. He's a Yoshevo Halim in a sense. You know? Someone who sits all day and goes to school and learns lives in a sort of utopia. Like when you go to yeshiva. Yeah, you go to yeshiva and they give you all your food and they take care of your laundry. I mean, all you got to do is wake up in the morning, And this isn't so easy, but you go there right in the morning, you go learn, and you go to sleep at night. And all of your other needs are taken care of.
Sounds like I need
it. Yeah. Yes. It's interesting. I was talking to somebody yesterday whose nephew is in rabbinical school, and they're married and they're expecting a child. And I said, the one thing that I regret about going into the rabbinate, when I first got married, so the first year, I took a job as a rabbinic intern. And in retrospect, I regret not having gone back to Israel together with my wife for a year and to learn another year in Eretz Israel. Because, you know, the people who do it, it's like on Aden, you know, like you just marry. What expenses do you have in that first year? So you need an apartment, so YU is very generous. They give you an apartment. They give you food. You know, you can almost live on nothing. And, it's, you know, and I always look back and say that I could have spent that year. And who knows, things probably would have ended up very differently. If I had spent that year, it would have been a... What? Probably not. Right, you know. There's a good
6 years.
Right. Well, that's a different story. I'm not going to go into that. You know, and when you live in this like euphoria world, everything is very pristine. Everything is black and white. Everything is also very simple. You know, in Yaakov's world, they don't have to cover over stones. They don't have to cover wells with stones because you're considerate of one another and you trust one another. And no one's going to take advantage of somebody else. Therefore, when Rivka comes to Yaakov and says, I want you to trick your father, she's asking you to do something that's completely antithetical to who he is. You want me to do what? Let me get this straight. You've been sending me to yeshiva for the past 45 years to learn to do this? That's what you want me to do?
Yeah.
And what Rivka tries to teach him, and he's going to learn the hard way. I mean, the really hard way is, you know, Yaakov, the world of the yeshiva is very nice. But not everybody plays by the rules of the yeshiva.
Not like real life.
That's not real life. You know, and Yaakov comes in with this, you know, bounding energy. You know, and we start off by asking, Mrs. Snow wants the answer to that question. Why did he come with no money? You know, why did Eliezer come with a ton of money? Because his master sent him. Why did Abraham? Abraham is a very worldly man. Abraham knows how things work in the world. Right? Yaakov, when he leaves, he's a grown up, he's going to go get married, right? He's going to do what his parents want. He has not learned it in the ways of the world.
Mm-hmm. It still doesn't explain why Rivka, she was the lady of the world. She lived with...
At 3 years old, she lived over there.
Ah, forget the 3 year old thing. Okay, don't get me started.
Why she didn't get him?
Well, maybe she didn't leave their stories first that somebody robbed him.
Maybe somebody robbed him. You know, but that would make more sense, right, that he got conned or something. You know what I'm saying? He met somebody on the way. He lost it. He whatever. It wouldn't. None of those things would surprise me. I mean, maybe she wasn't surprised. She wouldn't have been. Nothing would shock her. You know, the thing she was worried about most is she going to get there? You know, you can imagine. You send somebody. You tell them, okay, I want you to travel from here to there. You worry. Why are you worried? Because yeah, you're going to walk up. You know, somebody's going to take advantage of him.
Oh my God.
You know, how do I know that she has what to be concerned about being taken advantage of? How do I know? Because when he gets to his uncle's house, who takes advantage of him the most?
No.
His uncle.
She probably knows him too.
Yeah. That's right. Here's the irony. Who's better equipped to deal with Laban, Eliezer or Yaakov?
Eliezer.
By far.
Because in a sense,
one gets the sense that the story of Eliezer is there almost to create a contrast between how Eliezer deals with Laban and how Yaakov does. If you look at the end of Chayishar, I just don't turn, but you look at it and you say it says you see the end of the story, okay? You see Nunhei. I'm just reading it for you. They're ready to go. Rivka wants to go. He's ready. He stays one night. And he says, okay, next morning, we're out of here. Right? So they say, Pasuk Nunhei, Vayomer Achia Be'ima. So the brother and the mother say, they say, Teisheva Na'ara Itanu Yamim O Asor, Achar Teile. They already start. Stay a couple days, Yamim O Asor. Stay 10 days, stay in here, she's not ready to go yet. You know, like, how do we fetch all the money out of you now? What does Eliezer say? Vayomer al ta'achuroti v'ashem yitzriach darki shalchuni ve'elcha la'adoni. He says it very nicely, but what does he say? He says, under no circumstances am I staying here a minute longer than I have to. And because he's aware he's a man of the world.
He saw
what he knows what happens. What?
He saw what was happening.
Right. That's interesting. The thing that also Eliezer, it's interesting to note, the thing that happens, it's interesting to note, when is there another time, this is a tough Tanakh question, another time in Tanakh where somebody tries to get somebody to stay over? Somebody, anyone? Anyone? Mrs. Robert? No. I'll give you a Sophie. I'll give you a chocolate babka. Nobody wants my chocolate babka. Well, yeah, you're not kidding. When somebody asks somebody else, stay over, don't go. No. In Tanakh. The story of Pilegesh Begiva. Anybody, are you familiar? We did this in the Sefer of Shoftim. The story of Pilegesh Begiva. Zohar, you were there, I think. Right? We learned in the summertime. The story of Pilegesh Begiva ends up, it's a very story very similar to the story of Sodom, where this person comes to the place of Giva, and they steal his wife, and they rape her, and they leave her for dead, and in Binyamin, and it causes a great civil war among the Jewish people. Well, the story begins that a man got angry at his wife, and he throws her out, and then he goes back to get her back, and his father-in-law says, stay, and he stays one day, and he stays another day, and his father-in-law says, stay another day, and finally he says, I have to leave, and it's only because he leaves in the afternoon, because his father-in-law made him stay for breakfast, that he ends up late in Giva, and then they rape his wife, because he's stuck in the street with nowhere to stay. But the whole story starts with that same idea. Stay a little more, stay a little more, stay a little more. The Tanakh has very little patience for people who are, you know, when somebody gets says, oh, why don't you stay a little more, and you're wishy-washy, and you're wishy-washy, you know you're about to get taken advantage of. But Eliezer is decisive. No. I have a mission to accomplish. I'm going to leave. What does Laban say to Yaakov? Hang around a little bit. He stays a month. So then what does he say? What, all of a sudden, a month, what does a month turn into?
7 years.
What does 7 years turn into? 21 years.
And 21, yeah.
So he went to get a wife.
And he ended up being an old man by the time he got married.
That's right. No, no. He went to find a wife. 21 years later, maybe I should go home.
Wasn't he also hiding out from Israel?
How long did he plan on hiding out from Israel?
Well,
so did Hashem tell him? Did Hashem say you can't stay at Lavan?
No. No.
You think Esau didn't know where Esau knew where Yaakov was?
Yeah.
Well, they lived longer in those days. They didn't just live 70 years.
So what? You know, just the whole.
Didn't he worry about the influence?
No, I thought Esau.
Wouldn't you?
Yes.
Wouldn't you? You know, your grandfather is a child. Can you imagine, like, you married the mob boss's daughter, right? So, and you know, the guy's doing business dealings all the time. You know, it affects. How could it not affect?
Mm-hmm. Yaakov
thought that Esau was dead
because his nephew came and he gave him all his money.
He probably
told him he
killed
his father, and he's dead because he's a poor man.
So then let me ask you this question. When Yaakov sends this letter, hey, Esau, I'm coming home, how come Esau doesn't turn to Eliphaz and say, what?
Yes.
And Eliphaz says, it's a miracle! It's a miracle!
Yeah,
isn't it interesting? I just thought of this. Isn't there there's a whole midrash? How did Hercules come about in the whole Greek mythology? How does Hercules come about? Doesn't like one of the gods send some messenger to go kill the son of Zeus, and that's how he becomes immortal? Nobody else knows Greek mythology? I only know this because it was in the Disney cartoon. It was in the Disney movie. But it just got me thinking, maybe it was all based on this midrash of Eliphaz. That Esau sent Eliphaz to go kill the son, go kill Yaakov, and he doesn't kill him instead, but he turns him into somebody else, and all, then he becomes, you know, this great man. They all stole our, midrash from you, Esau. You know, they stole everything of us. All I can tell you is that from the beginning of this story, you'll read the rest of the story on your own because they're actually running out of time. One gets a very strong sense of Yaakov's naivete. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The thing could have to do with the money, how he came empty-handed. He's lying down in the middle of the field. Let's be honest, that's not the most intelligent thing to do. You know, seek a little shelter. Some rocks aren't really enough. HaKadosh Baruch Hu has come to him and say, Yaakov, I'm going to take care of you, because lo aleinu, what's going to happen to Yaakov if HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't protect him? You know, and that he gets a lessons in the way of the world. And in order to be Yaakov, you know, he sees these different contrasts. He sees that Yaakov is really mirroring his father. Right? What is Yitzchak doing? What's Yitzchak's whole life? Yitzchak's whole life, remember we said, was? Nothing. Stay at home. Be a firm person. Stay within yourself. Don't even reach out to other people, in a sense. Go out on your own. So here Yaakov is in a conundrum. Raised in the house of Yitzchak, but forced to live a life of Abraham. So what happens? You learn in the school of hard knocks. Right? You learn in the school of hard knocks. Your brother goes to kill you, right? So instead of fighting back, only later on does Yaakov get up the gumption to fight. And that's when Yaakov becomes Yisrael. Sarita im Elokim v'anashim. Not before. This parsha, he's always Yaakov. He's always Yaakov. Only the very, very end does he finally stand up to Lavan. When, after his father-in-law does a toothpick search of all of his possessions and can't find the idols, then finally does he stand up for himself. This whole parsha is about Yaakov being totally, you know, tread upon.
But he had the Amunah.
He always had the
Amunah. Good, Amunah is only gets you so far.
Right? Even
Abraham has Amunah too, but then what does he do? He goes fight a war. He goes to fight a war. Amunah only gets you so far. And I think that's sometimes a problem with the Jewish people. We sometimes think all we need to do is have Amunah. Oh, all we do is have Amunah. Nachnu, I mean, if it ain't by me, right? You have to always do is believe that Kadosh Baruch Hu, Rein Lanu, I mean, say, Ella, Abinu Shabasharayim, Kadosh Baruch Hu will take care of everything. Yeah, he will, if we take care of ourselves too.
Absolutely
correct. You know, and I, you can't minimize the Amunah. But if you maximize the Amunah to the point where you're not actually doing anything to help yourself,
no, it doesn't work.
Then work.
You
know, and I fear, I got to tell you, I fear, well, this brings us back to the whole Esav Shoni as Yaakov. I fear for the future of the Jewish people in America. Because we have a very, very believing firm community. The non-firm community, give them 100 years, it's big trouble. You know, big trouble. You know, the future of the non-firm community is just in terrible danger. They have the strength of numbers. Only because there are 5 million of them do they have the ability to continue. It's going down and down. If every 10 years it goes down by another 200,000, 300,000, so what's going to be left in 100 years? So who's going to be left? The frum. So we're so frum, and achli ma'aminim, we're big believers, right? It's very nice. We have amuna, amuna, amuna. But Kach Baruch Hu says, what are you going to do about it? The amuna only takes you so far. Yeah? Do we really want to relive that whole Eliphaz stealing all of our money and beating us up and leaving us for nothing? Because we don't have the Haftacha here in America of Yaakov Avinu.
When I was working for the government, there was a fellow sitting in front of me who used to talk to somebody, and he told me after he left that there's a whole network of anti-Semites in this country, that they have paraphernalia, papers, magazines every month and everything. And this,
of course, is a network. I don't think it's mainstream.
One of them. He said they hate the Jews just like the Nazis.
Oh, sure. I don't think it's mainstream. But I think it always lurks below the, it always bubbles below the surface.
And they hate Jews, and they're just waiting for their chance to do something to the Jews.
Yeah, what about, but I don't think that's a majority of people.
It's not a majority of the people in this country, but there's a good many of them.
What about the Ku Klux Klan? I mean, everybody knows about them.
You know, I think that's why I always have trouble with these Holocaust museums. You know, with the Holocaust museums.
They say that
I think the Holocaust museums are very nice. But when push comes to shove, do you think the Holocaust Museum is going to turn any one person from a son of Israel to an Oy of Israel?
God forbid it might give them some ideas.
I personally, from my perspective, from a historical perspective, I don't think these things make any difference. I think that the only thing that's going to ensure the survival of the Jewish people is Jewish education, is investing in our own children. Because all this investment we make, and you know, it's important to remember. But you don't have to remember if it's a $35 million museum.
Correct.
You have to remember.
But Rabbi, the people who go there are not Jews.
I understand that. So they say it has a profound impact. They say it has a profound impact. I don't know. I wonder.
Especially on children.
I'm sure it does, but I wonder over time, when the time comes, are they going to say, "Well, I saw the Holocaust Museum, and you know, therefore I'm not going to do it"? What?
Why is there so much bullying in
the school? You understand what I'm saying, Mrs. Snow? When push comes to shove, will the Holocaust Museum have made a meaningful impact? Well, the ADL made a meaningful impact. How come with all the ADLs pushing and shoving and all that, we're still fighting anti-Semitism in America, and it's getting worse?
Because it's
in the Yaakov. Ezel Sone is Yaakov. So therefore, is it really worth the investment?
You have to try.
What? You have to try. Well, so where is the best way of investing? That's the question. You know, I always say, talk about these seeds of peace, seeds of peace. You know, why are you so upset about seeds of peace? Because you take the same kids that got along wonderfully with the Israeli kids beautifully in Michigan, and you take them back, and then they hate each other again. Because it's not reality. It's not real world. It's like trying to create this little utopia. The world isn't a utopia. So we have to be prepared for it. Yeah, you have to have anachnu ma'aminim. You have to, where we believe. But also, you have to make our ishtavis as well. And Yaakov learns the hard way. And it's only when he grapples with Esav, when he's willing to stand up for himself and fight for it. You know, thank God we live at a time where I can talk about this. 100 years ago, I could never give this discussion. It wouldn't mean anything. Fight for what? But how come now we have a time where Jews have a concept of defending ourselves, and other Jews say, no, we can't do that? It really is incomprehensible to me.
You don't sign their names when
they... I don't know. All right.